This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, January 21st. I'm Laura Flanders. On today's program, some money for rebuilding Afghanistan is going to dig swimming pools. Vice President Dick Cheney helps Enron squeeze India, and activists and congresspeople in Washington, D.C. commemorate Dr. Martin Luther King's birthday with some tough questions for the Attorney General. But first, these headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. To commemorate Martin Luther King Jr. Day, African-American intellectuals, poets, activists, representatives from a variety of religious faiths, and artists gathered at the Metropolitan AME Church in Washington, D.C. The National Spiritual Peace with Justice Rally and Teach-In, which will run from 2 p.m. to 7 p.m. Eastern Time, was put together by Black Voices for Peace.
We celebrate King's Day in the right way by saying that we can never end terrorism by war while ignoring the conditions of the oppressed and the poor. We say that we celebrate King's Day the right way by saying right here in our nation's capital that we can be not so concerned about the tax base while we ignore the poor who have no hospital or living space.
That sound from WBIX, which webcast the events live. Black Voices for Peace was formed to discuss the idea that people of color in the U.S. and around the world have firsthand experience with the paradox that the United States government can prosecute acts of terrorism without taking full responsibility for the government's repressive history. The city of Modesto, California, did not want to sponsor an appearance by actor and activist Danny Glover at a Martin Luther King Jr. commemoration Saturday, but he spoke anyway. Kalia Ramirez has more.
The city of Modesto withdrew financial support, and Modesto Junior College withdrew its offer of a venue for the annual event after Glover sparked criticism in New Jersey last month by speaking against the death penalty, even for accused terrorist Osama bin Laden. Glover reminded the audience at Modesto's Christ Unity Baptist Church of Dr. King's own controversial views.
Let everyone share his dream of peace, his dream of reconciliation, his dream of redemption. And certainly not all of us agree with one of his most radical beliefs, the idea that we should somehow find it within us to try and love our enemies. It would certainly be something at this time to consider.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Kelia Ramirez.
Israeli tanks rolled into the West Bank town of Tukalrum today, and Igal Gilmore reports from Jerusalem.
Israeli forces arriving in a convoy of dozens of tanks, banked up by helicopters, thundered into the town in the early hours of the morning. In subsequent exchanges of gunfire, a 19-year-old Palestinian was killed and a 42-year-old critically wounded. The Israelis have justified the incursion on the grounds that the town, just across the Green Line from Israel, was the launch pad for last week's attack on a bat mitzvah coming-of-age party, in which six Israelis died. The Palestinians say the Israelis deliberately provoked that attack by assassinating Raed Karmi, the West Bank leader of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade. So once again, the crisis is locked into the familiar pattern of tit-for-tat violence, from which innocent civilians cannot escape. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Inigo Gilmore in Jerusalem.
This week, the French health system will come under severe strain with a series of strikes by hospital workers, nurses, and family doctors. Zoe Eisenstein reports from Paris.
The disruption began on Monday with a strike called by unions representing nearly 800,000 hospital staff. They want more jobs to make up for the government's legislation, which reduces the working week to 35 hours. The government says it will create 45,000 jobs, but health professionals who continue to work much longer hours say they want 80,000. On Tuesday, thousands of nurses are planning to demonstrate in the French capital. But the focus of the week is Wednesday, when family doctors, who for several weeks have been refusing nighttime and weekend calls, close their practices for 24 hours. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Zoe Eisenstein in Paris.
And finally, Zimbabwe police and their allied militia broke up a rally supporting the Opposition Movement for Democratic Change, or MDC, yesterday. Naeem Jinnah Files from Johannesburg, South Africa.
The rally was in the second largest city in Zimbabwe, Bulawayo, and was to be addressed by MDC leader Morgan Tsvangirai. It was part of Tsvangirai's campaign for the presidential elections scheduled for the 9th and 10th March. The MDC says Zimbabwe's self-styled pro-government war veterans occupied the stadium where the rally was to take place. Thousands of opposition activists were attacked by police, who fired tear gas at them and dispersed them. According to the MDC, the police did nothing to the war veterans. South African President Thabo Mbeki called Zimbabwe's upcoming election the most urgent issue facing the region and said a fraudulent election must be avoided. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Naeem Jina in Johannesburg.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
Japan is donating $2 billion for the reconstruction of Afghanistan. That announcement on the first day of a two-day United Nations summit in Tokyo. The Bush administration, which led the bombing campaign against the Central Asian nation, pledged 15% of Japan's total, $300 million. Afghanistan is beginning reconstruction nearly from scratch. Decades of war have all but leveled the country's infrastructure. The central bank was looted in the last days of the ousted Taliban regime, and government employees have not been paid for months. Free Speech Radio News correspondent Pratap Chatterjee is in Mazar-e Sharif in northern Afghanistan. He says a sizable chunk of the aid money currently flowing into the country is being spent on Land Rovers and swimming pools.
A lot of the UN operations out here have, you know, Land Rovers and Toyota Land Cruisers. So the agencies here would take over a large compound typically rented from a Afghan who has left the country and is living in Europe or some such thing, pays, you know, $1,000 in rent for a month. Where the World Food Program is operating out of is actually a house with a swimming pool, which is extremely unusual in this part of the world. So they set up in pretty nice buildings, and they all operate by satellite phone, which indeed is really the only way to communicate. And all of this costs a whole lot of money.
That's Free Speech Radio News correspondent Pratap Chatterjee speaking to us from Mazar-e Sharif in northern Afghanistan. Vice President Dick Cheney intervened with Indian officials last year as part of an effort to push through a $2.9 billion Enron power project. That disclosure from the White House, which attempted to downplay Cheney's conversation with Sonia Gandhi, the leader of India's opposition Congress Party, where the White House says Cheney pressured Gandhi to support Enron. The administration said its actions were in no way influenced by Enron's political contributions to George W. Bush. Enron was Bush's biggest political backer, heading into the 2000 presidential campaign, making about $623,000 in contributions to his campaigns since 1993, when he was raising money for his first Texas gubernatorial race. For a closer look at Enron's activities in India, here's Sputnik Kalambi in New Delhi.
India is following the events on Wall Street with great interest, not least because Dalal Street, the financial heart of India's commercial capital Bombay, is also feeling the heat after Enron's collapse. The Indian exchequer has taken a huge beating. The Enron plant in the western Indian state of Maharashtra was built largely with Indian money. The charges against Enron in India are numerous, from human rights violations to negative economic and ecological consequences. Economist Jyoti Ghosh of Delhi's JNU University says Enron Gate is an example of the U.S. being hoist on its own petard.
You know, the United States is the one that has been most vehement about crony capitalism in Asia. So I think the explicit revelation of this degree of crony capitalism in the United States is quite interesting for us. Second thing I think is that, you know, this is the company that got the Fortune Most Innovative Company 6 years in a row. It's been getting awards from everyone in sight precisely for the activities which brought it to ruin. And I think that tells us a little bit about the kind of market structures that have emerged in the 1990s, especially in the U.S.
The Dabhol Power Company, set up with great fanfare in 1996 in the western Indian state of Maharashtra, with a 65% stake for Enron, has all but ceased to exist, though moves are afoot for the one remaining plant to pass into private Indian hands. The $2.9 billion power project was India's biggest foreign investment ever and was supposed to be the world's largest natural gas-fired power plant and bring power and employment to Maharashtra, then ruled by the Hindu supremacist Shiv Sena, an ally of the BJP, which heads the coalition government. Columnist Praful Bidwai is among several here who warned from the outset that the project was unnecessary, ecologically and economically unsound. It was imposed on India, he says, by massive US arm twisting.
The US ambassador then in India, as well as the White House chief of staff, were on record as more or less threatening the Indian government and the Maharashtra government with withholding of all foreign investment projects and multilateral aid projects unless Enron was pushed through. This was one of the main reasons why the project was closed. It's financially sealed in a great rush in 1995 in breach of various domestic laws in India.
The then U.S. Energy Secretary went as far as threatening to scupper India's relations with international financial institutions if the deal didn't go through. Meanwhile, in response to charges by Human Rights Watch that the Dabhol Power Corporation employed security forces who routinely beat and harassed people demonstrating peacefully against the power plant, Ambassador Frank Wissner said he was unaware of such reports. Ambassador Wissner was named to Enron's board of directors a few months after he left his post in India in 1997. A huge contribution to the Clinton administration also helped push the deal, says Bidwai.
In 1995, Kenneth Lay also donated $100,000 to the Democratic National Convention. And this was literally days before the financial closure of the Dabhol power project in India. And you had all this massive pressure building up, along with, of course, bribery and domestic pressure tactics used by Enron, which pushed that project through, and not only pushed it through, but actually expanded its scope.
The project had expanded to three times its original size by the time it took off, tripling the losses of the public exchequer. Jyoti Ghosh again.
The power plant was pushed through at a much more exorbitant price because of the corruption. It's basically uneconomic and unfeasible. So the entire plant is effectively a waste. It's then embroiled with it a large number of public financial institutions who are playing with taxpayers' money and who will now sink with the company. In fact, it's got to the point where there are Indian companies willing to buy the domestic assets of Enron for a price which is higher, apparently, than the total valuation of Enron in the United States.
Enron in India, adds Praful Bidwai, is a classic colonial contract. The way it was rammed through speaks volumes about the nature of the Indo-US relationship.
Over the last 5 years, we've seen massive changes in India's foreign policy orientation. From a non-aligned power, it's become very aligned to the United States, courting the United States as its most allied ally, if you like. And so it's in this context that we must see the way the Enron contract was pushed through. There was no will on the part of the government of India to stall, resist, renegotiate the project.
The result? Indian financial institutions are in imminent danger of losing their entire $1.7 billion investment, triggering their own collapse unless immediate measures are taken. Unfortunately, say critics, the government doesn't seem to understand the enormity of what is happening. Economist Jyoti Ghosh.
The basic alternative would be to empower the state electricity boards, give them financial resources to order the equipment domestically from BHEL, which is lying with unutilized capacity. That will improve the profits of BHEL. These are internationally competitive, perfectly viable power equipment. So the state electricity boards can set up power plants as in the public sector, as per the requirement, and save money all around for the government of India, as well as provide more infrastructure.
Sputnik Kilambi in Delhi for Free Speech Radio News.
Congresspeople and civil rights leaders in the nation's capital are marking the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday with a call for peace and justice and some tough questions for Attorney General John Ashcroft. Joshua Chaffin reports from Washington.
Elected officials and civil rights leaders of various colors remembered Martin Luther King Jr. on Saturday at the D.C. Convention Center. The event was subtitled Protecting Civil Liberties. Event sponsors say King's message of peace and justice is more appropriate now than ever, given the way the country is reacting to the September 11th attacks. Civil rights activist the Reverend Al Sharpton says the King holiday is the right time to raise questions about Attorney General John Ashcroft's tactics, roving wiretaps, monitoring attorney-client conversations, detaining suspects under no criminal charge, and especially racial profiling.
The whole idea of profiling Arabs, saying that out of the 314,000 people that could be deported, they're making it a priority to go after 6,000 people of Arab descent. It is our belief if Dr. King were alive, Dr. King would be dealing with these issues. We unequivocally join the fight against terrorism, but we do not feel that you have to sacrifice civil liberties and civil rights to fight terrorism. And racial profiling does not fight terrorism. If anything, it creates the climate that terrorists feed on to make anti-American sentiment high around the world.
Two lawsuits against the federal government were filed by the American Civil Liberties Union last week, one on behalf of a woman who was subjected to repeated invasive searches in Chicago's O'Hare Airport. The suit contends the woman was targeted only because she's an American of Pakistani descent. The other ACLU lawsuit challenges a new federal law to tighten airport security. The law says all airport baggage handlers must be American citizens.
And the irony of this is that there's a large class of U.S. citizens called legal permanent residents. These are people who have green cards, who have been given authorization to work in the United States.
Laura W. Murphy is the director of the Washington National Office of the ACLU. She's a featured speaker at another D.C. Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial, sponsored by a group called Black Voices for Peace, this afternoon.
People really don't understand the rights that immigrants now have and why they are there and why it's important to keep them. And we're now entering a phase of tremendous immigrant bashing in this country's economy, its military, and its computer industry, for example, is dependent on legal permanent residents.
Some 25% of airport baggage handlers in the United States look destined to lose their jobs in the name of national security. But the ACLU says that the airline employees are just some of the people of color who could be permanently affected by post-9/11 government policies. And still in the background this King holiday is the fact that George W. Bush was declared the victor in last year's presidential election. Bush took the state of Florida by just over 500 votes, even as thousands of mostly Democrat African-American voters were turned away at the polls. Add to that the fact that Florida doesn't allow its ex-convicts the right to vote, and the ranking minority member of the House Judiciary Committee, John Conyers, says it's time for a change.
We have a job to do, and that is to persuade everybody in the Congress to stay on the strongest provisions of Senator Chris Dodd's bill to get this voting business straightened out. And until we do that, we're back in 1968 when we were still trying to get the vote, trying to get people registered, trying to allow people to run for office.
For Free Speech Radio News, this is Joshua Chaffin in Washington, D.C.
This is Alamine's letter from a Fulton County jail.
Death Row commentator Mumia Abu-Jamal.
The U.S. civil rights movement has, as one of its highlights, the searing letter written by the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. from the sweltering stench of a jail in Birmingham, Alabama. In it, Dr. King lacerates the inability of his white fellow Christians to see and act against the great injustice of the American apartheid system of segregation in the South. His indictment of them for their condemnation of his participation in civil rights protests stands the test of time as a record of resistance to the evils that states perform with the silent acquiescence of the well-to-do. It was smuggled out of jail and served to spur that movement forward to greatness. Recently, another African-American clergyman sent a letter to his fellow believers about matters of great import and state injustice. Yet this clergyman was punished by the state for daring to write from his cell in protest of a great social evil. That clergyman is Imam Jamil Abdullah Alamin, formerly a youthful associate of the late Dr. King, who was then known as H. Rapp Brown. When Dr. King wrote and smuggled out his letter, he was a man convicted of violating the civil laws of Alabama. Imam Alamin is convicted of nothing, but the hallowed presumption of innocence means nothing, for the state, the very entity that seeks to take his life and freedom, bids him to be silent. But it matters to the state because Alamin is a Muslim in a time and in a place that such a faith is perceived by the wider society as an unclean violation, a dimly felt precursor to the scourge of terrorism. In the tradition of one of the mentors of his radical youth, Imam Al-Amin speaks truth to power, both to those who follow his chosen faith, Islam, and to others who do not. He proudly proclaims his innocence and states clearly the state's objectives: to kill him. He says, quote, "It is a violation of my most basic rights as a citizen, as a human being, and as a servant of Allah, God, to prevent me, as an accused man faced with death, from speaking the truth that can set me free. O you who believe, you with whom I have fasted during our sacred month of Ramadan, you with whom I have broken my fast and have shared from the common plate of Allah's bounty, you with whom I have prayed and shared my faith with, you with whom I have struggled to build a better world, hear me when I declare that I've committed no crime before Allah or man, that I've violated no law, civil or eternal, that the life or the blood of the men I am accused of injuring and killing is neither on my hand or my conscience, for I have done them no harm," he writes. Imam Al-Amin expresses regret for the loss and injuries to the men, and then writes of the sacredness of all human life. He then eloquently condemns capital punishment. Quote, "State executions are little more than ritual murders that mock justice, a bloodlust, a blood sport, a spectator sport, an act of state-sponsored terror rooted in avarice, hatred, and revenge without the benefit of moral sanctions or the capacity for justice. It is the willful, arbitrary act by the state perpetrated against the poor, the powerless, the penniless, and the despised. There are no millionaires on death row. It is as evil and cruel a punishment as the Roman circus feeding men to lions. It is no less arbitrary and no less brutal. It is no less a sacrifice.
You have 1 minute left to talk.
The ancient practice of human sacrifice. He asserts proudly that the power of his religion's conversion has meant that he is no longer the man known, through news clippings at least, as H-Rap Brown. Where once he was a political rebel against the American way of apartheid, he is now a being of faith, and his resistance is spiritual. He writes, quote, "I have languished in the dungeons of their prison. I have walked through the shadows of death, and I fear no evil. I remain unbroken and unbowed before the powers and principalities of kings and of state. I fear and bow only to Allah." Those are the words of Imam Jamil Abdullah Al-Amin.
You have 15 seconds left to talk.
Those are the words of a man who is fighting to be free and to live. From death row, this is Mumia Abu Jamal.
Guatemala's Highlands Indigenous Center, Quetzaltenango, was backdrop to a three-day gathering of diverse groups of peoples from Mexico and Central America to discuss the imminent effects of the Plan Puebla Panama. This mega infrastructure project would create a series of transportation corridors and open access to mineral and biological resources, as well as develop export processing zones throughout the region. Tim Russo and Luz Ruiz report from the Forum Xelahu, where activists, indigenous peoples, academics, and workers came together to strategize, organize, and build alternatives to combat the potential impacts of the Plan Puebla Panama on their communities.
Frente al Plan Puebla Panamá.
Resistencia y dignidad.
Frente al Plan Puebla Panamá.
Resistencia y dignidad.
President Vicente Fox's presidential project for his six-year term, Plan Puebla Panamá, is the most ambitious macroeconomic infrastructure project proposed for Mexico and Central America in decades. Fox has vowed to push forward Plan Puebla Panamá at all costs, despite broad resistance from opposition parties, non-governmental organizations, Mexican and Central American civil society, indigenous peoples throughout Mesoamerica, and more than a dozen guerrilla groups currently active in Mexico. For 3 days in late November, more than 800 people representing 262 organizations from Mexico and Central America gathered in Quetzaltenango, Guatemala, at the Foro Xelahu to discuss, analyze, and reject Plan Puebla Panamá and its affiliated regional development projects. Representatives came to learn more about Plan Puebla Panamá and discuss strategies to combat the neoliberal economic policies driving this development plan and setting stage for the free trade area of the Americas. Brendan O'Neill from Acerca offered details on the themes discussed in the Foro Xelahu.
We discussed the impacts of Plan Puebla Panamá. This is a development project, or couched as a development project by Vicente Fox, the president of Mexico, but This is another example of corporate globalization from above, and the consensus from everyone was that the Isthmus of Central America and Southern Mexico is not for sale, meaning that this is a project to develop this region. One more example of the extension of NAFTA, the FTAA, the Plan Pueblo Panama, all driven by the same logic, which is not putting the people in the pueblo before capital, before investment.
When interviewed during the Foro Xelajú, Neil Harvey considered that Plan Pueblo Panama verges on economic blackmail for indigenous communities with clear counterinsurgency objectives. Harvey is an author and professor at New Mexico State University.
Yes, I think these plans, in the case of Chiapas, with a clear goal of defeating the Zapatistas as a model of development through counterinsurgency or counterinsurgency through development. In Chiapas, it's been occurring prior to the Plan Pueblo Panama back in 1994, as soon as the rebellion occurred. It hasn't functioned in the way that the government would have wished. The Zapatistas are still present, they're still a political force, and they're still a point of reference for other organizations throughout the continent, throughout the world.
Glenn Cooker, a professor at DePaul University in Indiana, expounded upon Harvey's notion by explaining how neoliberal economic policies create a multi-tiered system based around export processing factories, maquiladoras, and U.S. interests to halt migration to the States.
There's an economic aspect to this that by freezing labor, what they want to do is to create a three-tier production system where the highest level of labor will be in the United States with the most skilled labor and the highest paid labor with the most benefits and packages and levels of unionization. And then a mid-tier kind of labor system in Mexico, but especially northern Mexico, that'll be higher wages than you'll see in southern Mexico, Central America. A third tier, the lower tier, that'll be southern Mexico, Central America, which will principally be a maquila sector where people are forced off their land, won't be able to migrate. The only place that they can go then is into maquila production, right, which is part of the overall design of Plan Pueblo Panama. So if you're going to have people working in the maquilas, that labor needs to be frozen. It can't migrate. And it also has to be, you know, deprived of their other forms of economic activity, agricultural activity, by taking their lands away and by making it uncompetitive, impossible to compete with production from the United States. It's profoundly unfair, profoundly unjust.
The Foro Xelajú culminated in a march of more than 1,000 people throughout the streets of Xela, chanting resistance in the face of Plan Pueblo Panama. Lisette from Los Angeles was leaving the forum feeling inspired to educate herself more and begin organizing.
I think I still need to learn a lot, but I think this is a good beginning just to see what people are doing in other countries to resist these kind of projects. It's very inspiring just to see how many people want to be involved and want to do something about it.
This is Tim Russo from Xela, Guatemala.
Free Speech Radio News is a production of Pacifica Reporters Against Censorship. Over 40 reporters in 14 states and on 4 continents are on strike against Pacifica Network News for its censorship of legitimate news stories. A big welcome today to listeners at WBAI in New York City. I'm Laura Flanders.
I'm Sputnik Kilambi in India. I report for Free Speech Radio News because it brings you the voices of the people and not just those who claim to speak in the name of their people. Free Speech Radio News only stays on the air with your financial support. Please make a donation to Free Speech Radio News online at www.fsrn.org, that's www.fsrn.org, or call 510-287-5551, that's 510-287-5551.